Good evening. Happy New Year. You're probably the last people I will wish that to. Welcome to 2024 and the first of this year's episodes of Have We Got Pain News For You. I'm Charlie Banner from Keating Chambers. Before we begin, can I please remind you to consider making a donation to charity in lieu of registration fee. Regular viewers will know that we endorse, amongst other things, the GoFundMe Ukraine page, any of the energy crisis charities, Brian May's Save Me for the environmental and nature crisis, and Shelter for the housing crisis. But of course, please do consider making a donation to a local charity of your choice if you prefer. We're delighted this evening to have as our special guest none other than the Attorney General, the Right Honourable Victoria Prentice, KCMP, who we met before Christmas and who Paul had led a stimulating and interesting interview with her. Because Paul did the interview, we're pre-recorded. That means that Paul's task today is to literally just sit there and say nothing, actually, and sit in a car, no less, which is his favourite pastime apart from acting as a planning barrister. And you'll have to tell us, Paul, in a moment, which particular car park you're frequenting on this particular occasion. But before I do, let me introduce the rest of the panel. Chris is otherwise engaged in a family commitments list this evening. So starting, as always, with Mary, the Wandsworth Woods have made a comeback in the show in recent episodes. How are you doing? And Happy New Year to you.
It's lovely to see you. And Happy New Year to you, Charlie, Sasha, Paul, and everyone else listening. Lovely to be here. Mary Cook from Town Legal. And I'm drinking a cup of Yorkshire's finest brew. And all is well.
Very good to hear it, Mary. Sasha, in your recently refurbished room?
Yes, I lied to you. I am Charlie Banner. That's very good addition. We got Plan New Zealand.
No.
I am in London and I'm lovely. I wish Happy New Year to all our viewers. It's lovely to see you all virtually yet again and our fourth year of production.
Indeed so, indeed so. And our favourite travelling correspondent, which particular car park are you frequenting today?
I can thoroughly recommend the trip back from Maidstone, and I'm on my way back to the northeast. I'd hoped to get as far as home, or at least somewhere which looked like an office, but I found my way to, I don't know if you can see, Burger King, by the side of Doncaster on the A1, and it's utterly, utterly charming. I've even found a lighting crew.
Product placement. How much did you take from Burger King?
Well, never mind Burger King. What about DLB, Brick?
Yeah.
I know. I'm
thinking.
How much you taking from them? Good point.
Yeah, they bought me the coffee.
She's on fire. He's on fire. Great stuff. Well, without further ado, straight back to you, Mary. You're going to tell us what the latest planning news is since we last met.
Well, indeed. And of course, we last met on our special just before Christmas. And that was to talk about the new MPPF. And it's worth just reminding everyone that on the 21st of December, the chief planner, Jo Averley, issued another one of her updating newsletters. And that drew attention, obviously, to the MPPF update. And it's also worth saying that there was a reissue of the MPPF immediately after our show, which isn't drawn attention to in that written in her letter. But she also talks about the written ministerial statement, the Secretary of State's speech. And she also echoes and draws attention to what the Secretary of State said about the role, the important role that planners play in local government. So there seems to be, again, this continuing theme, and let's hope that's the government puts its money where its mouth is, so to speak. Second thing I want to remind everybody is that on the 26th of December, LURA came into force, or at least some of the provisions of the Levelling Up and Regeneration Act came into force. And in particular, quite a lot of the provisions which enable the Secretary of State to make regulations came into force, because much of the teeth of this is going to come later through the regulations. Thirdly, on the 22nd of December, DLUHC issued a consultation paper on street votes. And those of you particularly interested in that have, I think, until the 16th, no, sorry, the 2nd of February in order to respond to that matter. Fourthly, we mentioned on our special the review of the London plan that the Secretary of State had ordered, and Lichfields have been appointed to support Christopher Kotowski KC, who's leading that panel. And they're going to land on Monday. The report is going to land on the desk on Monday. Sadly, I think the next point I want to just draw attention to is the much publicized resignation of Chris Skidmore. I mean, who of course was the author of that independent review on net zero. And although he leaves the House, and that is a shame, I think he's very much going to be continuing in his role in promoting all things net zero. And so I watch with interest to see what happens to his career post-Parliament. And the other thing to say is that Duloc, the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, and the Department for Energy Security have also issued a paper about the historic buildings and changes to historic buildings in order to make them more energy efficient. And so there is more guidance out of a positive nature in relation to that. So those are my sort of six headline points. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Mary. Incredible turnaround time by Chris Kotowski and his team, that review.
Yes.
So it'll be very interesting to see what that says once we get to read it. Good. Well, I'm going to deal with the first of the case reports. And I'm going to discuss a case called Fiske, F-I-S-K-E, a judgment of the Court of Appeal, leading judgment, of course, by Sir Keith Lindblom, the president of, senior president of tribunals, and issued just before Christmas. And this was a Court of Appeal case really dealing with some of the, one of the following implications of the recent judgment of the Supreme Court in Hillside. So the issue in this case was whether Test Valley Borough Council had gone wrong in law when they granted planning permission for a substation to connect to an already consented solar park. And the particular question was whether they'd unlawfully failed to have regard to a material consideration by not taking into account what the claimant says was the incompatibility of the planning permission under challenge for the substation on the one hand with the planning permission for the solar park on the other hand. And they said, well, that gave rise to a Hillside issue that implementing the substation permission would mean that it was no longer possible to rely upon the solar park permission. That was a material consideration that should, as a matter of law, have been taken into account. Now, the Court of Appeal, in agreement with the High Court, rejected that argument and dismissed the appeal. And they said that the incompatibility between the two planning permissions was a matter, at least on the facts of that case, for the developer, and not a matter that the council was legally obliged to grapple with in its decision. And although it wasn't necessary for the court's termination of the appeal, they went on to agree with the council submission by Robin Green, who's my junior in the Hillside case, that in any event, the incompatibility within the two permissions wasn't an insuperable obstacle on the facts of that case, and there may have been ways to work around it so as to ensure that the two developments could come forward side by side without any Hillside issue. Now, there's been a lot of comment on this judgment on the internet, on LinkedIn, etc. And I think it's important to clarify what the judgment means, but also what it doesn't mean. Does the judgment mean that the Hillside implications, if I can call it that, the potential for a later permission to deprive the landowner of the ability to rely on an earlier permission, do the Hillside implications of a proposed development, are they never a relevant consideration? No, the judgment doesn't say that they're never a relevant consideration. The court was only concerned with whether the council on the facts of that case were legally obliged to take into account the Hillside implications of the later application on the facts of that case. Now, the court saying there was no legal obligation to take into account the hillside implications doesn't mean that as a matter of planning judgment, discretion, a local authority has the power to, if they think it appropriate to do so. And further, there might be some factual situations in other cases where it could be said to be legally necessary to take into account hillside implications in the sense it would be irrational not to do so. For example, where there were obvious public interest consequences from the earlier planning permission no longer being able to rely upon. So it couldn't be said it's just the developer's problem. So, for example, if a permission for three homes on a wider development site could be said to mean that the earlier permission for the wider development site can no longer be relied upon, the loss of housing land supply might be a public interest issue. So I think it's important to appreciate that the case doesn't establish any general legal principle that the hillside implications can never be a mandatory consideration. It doesn't establish a general principle that they always aren't a mandatory consideration. It's a matter of planning judgment on the facts of any particular case. So I think it's important to clarify that. But finally, it's an interesting illustration of the follow-up implications of hillside. I know there's one or two other cases, for example. I think there's one currently doing the rounds as to whether it's possible to under Section 96A to make an existing planning permission severable. The Supreme Court in Hillside having said that if you have got a severable permission, that would be a workaround from hillside implications, and that's doing the round. So the Supreme Court's judgment has stimulated a whole succession of potential follow-up cases, of which this is one. And with that, I will pass Sasha to you, and you're going to tell us about a case involving Lidl supermarkets.
I am, and Aldi. I'm going to take Mary Hall and myself back to the glory days of retail circuses or beauty parades, which was
Star Wars.
Well, I'm too young to remember that.
Yeah, well, they were much fun and a very interesting era when there was so much need for additional floor space. But as we know, Lidl and Aldi are both in the middle of very, very strong expansion plans throughout the UK. And this particular example, I am going to deal with a particular example, which is a leave. It's not the final decision, but I think it's worth bringing to our viewers' attention because it's quite an interesting case involving where you have two rival applications sitting before a local authority, in this case, East Lindsey. And I'm not going to do a poll and get the wrong county. As I understand it, it's in Lincolnshire. And it basically, both Aldi and Lidl had applications for their discount food stores in effectively the town of Horncastle. Now, they started off roughly at the same stage, and during the consideration of the applications by East Lindsey, Lidl amended their application, reduced the floor space proposed. So they felt, which necessitated a fresh round of consultation, which effectively enabled Aldi to go to the committee earlier, and effectively that was in last November, November 22, and a planning permission was granted but by East Lindsey to Aldi. And interestingly, the context of the two applications is that there was acceptance that if they were both granted, there would be harm to the centre in line with the guidance in the then NPPF. So there was only room retail expenditure for one. Now, interestingly, in the planning officer's report, the view was reached in terms, and I should get this right because it's so important, the planning officer said in terms that the outcome of the Lidl application is therefore uncertain at this stage, and therefore it is open to the council to consider the Aldi application on its own. Now, it's not a particularly good phraseology. Uncertain at this stage. What that really, in factual matters, meant is the Lidl application hadn't yet gone to committee. And consequently, the officers then concluded it would not be reasonable to withhold determination of the Aldi scheme. And therefore, they granted consent for that Aldi scheme. And the Lidl scheme, as we know, was still behind in the queue and had not been yet taken to committee. So, after the grant of planning permission, not unsurprisingly, Lidl have effectively sought to challenge the grant of that consent on the basis that it is a material consideration, the fact that they have a application before the authority. And as those lawyers amongst us know, the seminal case back in 95 was a case called Edwards, and this very interesting discussion about what burden is upon a local authority in relation to alternatives when they're considering an application. And as all three of you will be able to recite, the four principles that deal with alternative sites are set out in the Edwards case. Don't worry, I'm not testing you, Paul. You've got enough stress at the moment sitting in the service station to recall the tenets of Edwards. But basically, the court held that Edwards potentially was in play because it was procedurally unfair, potentially, to determine the Audi application until the outcome of comments on the Lidl application and the schemes could be considered together. So that ground was effectively procedurally unfair to proceed, but also it was a material consideration, the Lidl existence, and if both schemes were considered together, potentially the outcome might have been different. It would have been open potentially to members to have granted Lidl and refused Aldi. So watch this space. I know from having discussed with one of the advocates who are involved, that was heard in Leeds, in the administrative court in Leeds. There isn't yet a date set for the substantive hearing, but that hearing and that case will be very, very important on the consideration of alternative schemes for members and local authorities. So watch this space, Charlie.
Thanks, Sasha. That's very important.
Sasha, is it worth noting the identity of the judge? Because that may not be known to all of our audience.
Deputy High Court Judge Karen Ridge.
Ex-inspector.
Yeah.
Paul's match.
First ex-inspector.
Yes, indeed so. Indeed so.
Amazing
eyes. And a lady.
Indeed. And well all done, her. I think she sits on various tribunals too as a portfolio judge. So, no, absolutely. Good. Well, now we're going to go to a pre-recorded slot from Chris, who, as I say, can't be here for family reasons. So, Chris, in Hounslow, over to you.
Okay, thank you, Charlie. I've got a very interesting case this week. It is about a residential development, but it's about the development around it, and also it provides a new sand school as well. So, Rob brings up the first slide. We can see it's an appeal in Hounslow in London, A2 Dominion Developments, and for a special school and 124 residential units. And the reason it's interesting, if we go to paragraph 2, is that two parties were granted Rule 6 status in the case. The Gurdwara Sikh Temple, which is adjacent to the site, and also there was a management company for residential flats at Perkin Close. The case concerns the concept of agent of change, which we know is set out in the MPPF. Now, we go to the next slide. This is a picture of the temple, and the site is immediately adjacent to this. And the concern really was the noise generated from the temple. But the concern was those running the temple, the Sikh community, were particularly concerned that the new residential development would inhibit the activities on their site. Now, if we go to the next slide, we can see that the site was actually allocated for development, and it had already been cleared for its educational and residential purposes. The issue then is agent of change, and we go to the next paragraph. We can see that the framework, as we know, seeks to ensure that new development can be integrated effectively with existing businesses and communities, including places of worship. And we've seen this issue with various issues like nightclubs in the Ancoats area in Manchester and in Birmingham as well, and making sure that all the new regeneration and significant residential development doesn't inhibit existing uses. It says, as the inspector says, existing facilities should not have unreasonable restrictions placed on them, such as, for example, the worship cannot be carried out at certain times of the day because of the new residential development that's come in. If we carry on, we can see that the operation of an existing community facility, the MPPF tells us, could have a significant adverse effect on new development in its vicinity, and the applicant or agent of change should be required to provide suitable mitigation before the development has been completed. And that was an important case issue in this case because of the Gurdwara temple. And we carry on. We know that the potential adverse effects are defined, but the important thing is that they should be mitigated so as to ensure suitable living conditions in the case of residential development and minimise the potential for complaints against the existing facility. And the development should therefore be designed to ensure that noise and other nuisance generating uses such as light and odour uses remain viable and can continue to grow. So companies that are making food, for example, I've had this in Birmingham, are able to continue to operate even though new residential development comes into a gentrified area. If we go forward, what the inspector, Mr. Boniface, observed was the Gurdwara is a sizable facility serving people in a wide geographical area. This is obviously the Sikh community in West London, and it provides religious and community activities throughout the year, operating every day from the early hours of the morning. It's attended by a significant number of people for a place of worship, to receive a meal or engage in education and community facilities. And of course, they have ceremonies like weddings and funerals there on a regular basis. So nobody disputed that it was a well-used facility and that activity continues throughout the year and the site is routinely used. If we go forward, we can see that it was agreed the activities had the potential to disturb neighbouring uses. So nobody was arguing that there wasn't a potential conflict there. And in particular, the playing of the nagara, a ceremonial drum in the outside areas. As the inspector observed, and this is important, this occurs on a relatively infrequent basis, up to an hour per month in the courtyard during the Gatka demonstration. It's monthly. And during three other events per year, once as part of a procession around Hounslow and two flag-raising ceremonies that take place in the ceremonial area in front of the Gurdwara, again for relatively short periods. So the inspector is looking specifically at the primary noise source, which is the nagara, the ceremonial drum, and observing quite rightly that it's not taking place all of the time, far from it. It's an infrequent event. And all of us in an urban area have got to get used to certain amounts of noise and activity. And that was what the inspector was observing. If we go forward, he observed that the Gurdwara had the potential to generate significant amounts of noise, but the appellant had taken that into account during the application stage, and further details of activities were undertaken and they were subsequently provided by the Gurdwara. And so the appellant liaised with them and the council during the course of the planning application, which this is exactly what should happen. The applicant is taking into account what is actually taking place on the site and communicating with the temple to find out what the noise sources would be. If we go forward, the inspector refers to Pro-PG Noise Planning and Noise. Now, this is a document that's been produced which suggests that good acoustic design involves careful planning of the development right from the design concept, having regard to existing noise sources, and design should seek to avoid noise impacts through distance and layout. But there are circumstances where you'd need to have screening or soundproofing. And that guidance, not to be confused with the PPG, if we just have a look, is guidance that's been produced by various professional bodies to help guide the issue of noise and mitigating it, particularly in respect of residential, whether the noise source is like this or is from roads or trains or so on. Okay, moving forward then. And the inspector says the Gurdwara is one of many noise sources in this busy urban environment. Others include the heavily trafficked Hanworth Road, and the aviation noise from Heathrow's airport flight path. And of course, we're in Hounslow, so Heathrow is inevitably going to be a feature of the noise environment here. The building has been designed to a high acoustic specification to mitigate the impact of the noise sources and was designed to create a relatively quiet communal courtyard amenity space for future residents sheltered by the enclosed buildings. And of course, those buildings would have a benefit for the proposed school. So it wasn't just those from the neighbouring activities, but also those within the development. And that, of course, is the pupils and teachers at the school who would want an appropriate noise environment as well. If we go forward, we can see that really the case hinged on the use of the British standard 8233, and so guidance on sound, insulation and noise reduction. We've all done cases involving this. And the council's noise expert accepted during the inquiry that if this was the correct standard, and we all know about having endless disputes about what is the correct standard, but if that's the correct standard, he accepted then suitable living conditions would be achieved for future residents and that there would be no reasonable grounds for complaint. And in the end, the inspector thought that was the appropriate standard. So we can see a very interesting case involving an unusual neighbour and being resolved through understanding our neighbours, which is really what we should do. Another feature of the case, which is going forward, is that the inspector had to consider the public sector equality duty. And of course, race and religion or belief are protected characteristics and are, amongst other things, it's necessary to foster good relations between those with a protected characteristics and those without. And then this lovely line from the inspector: multiculturalism in London is to be celebrated and communities are typically made up of people of all races and religions living side by side, often in a dense urban environment. And in this case, I do not consider the ceremonial area, the car park, inherently requires a high degree of privacy or that a degree of mutual overlooking would be undesirable or unusual in Hounslow. And isn't that the truth? The benefits of a multicultural society. Let's hope all politicians understand that. Well done to everybody involved. Everybody was well represented. This is how we resolve these issues. And so if we look at the appearances, well done to the appellants team. James Strawn was leading that team. And we can see everybody involved. Well done. Very interesting case. Thank you very much, Charlie.
Thank you, Chris. And now we go to our interview, well, led by Paul, with the Attorney General. We'll sign off the live show now. We'll see you on the 25th of January for our second episode of the year. So thank you very much for coming. Please don't forget the charity donation. And now for the interview. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. So thank you, Victoria, for coming on. So the Right Honourable Victoria Prentice, KC, MP, DSO with Bar, many, many letters after your name. What an absolute joy to have you on the show. You are here in your capacity as the Attorney General. Six barristers on the call, I think, for almost the first time. We've had a couple of occasions, but almost the first time. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Lovely to be here. I'm only concerned that the planning bar will not be operating for the next half hour or so while we all chat away.
we can cope. They'll cope without us, but briefly. So can I, I've got a series of questions that I'm going to ask you and then the others will have a series of questions. So can I start off by a question for our audience, really? Obviously, this is not me. I think I know what the Attorney General does. But could you give us a basic insight as to what your job is on a day to day?
Well, it is quite basic. It's very much that a legal job like any other lawyer. I am the main provider of legal advice to government. So I'm an in-house lawyer. I attend cabinet and I try and keep my mouth shut if the matter isn't legal. But when there is a legal issue or something that might become a legal issue, I put my hand up and I give advice. And I broadly, like any other in-house lawyer, expect that advice will be listen to and treated seriously. I also, obviously, you know, I attend lots of cabinet committees as well, some of which more legal than others. And I advise on both legislation that's coming up and also litigation, which a government's involved in. So it's a very, it's not a grand role like that of the Lord Chancellor. He has other duties to the rule of law, which partially I also share, but he has a more ceremonial role. My role is very much that of in-house practical lawyer.
Thank you. That's extremely helpful. So you qualified as a barrister back in 1995, notwithstanding your youthful good looks.
Thanks for that. I was very young.
Well, you're younger than me, so that's all I count for. It's quite terrifying when you encounter people that you're against who have actually been born after you started, which is what I'm currently encountering.
I find that quite a lot.
Yeah. So you qualified back in, I think, about 2018. Your career rapidly took you into the Treasury Solicitors Department, which we now know charmingly as the Government Legal Department. where you rose to co-lead in the justice and security team, which sounds very exciting. And then in 2014, you left GLD and sought election as a Conservative candidate for Banbury. Now, I have to say, I'm interested in terms of a variety of ways in which you may have encountered the planning system, because I know well, back in 2010, the inspiration that got you into politics, he says, can be completely untrue, was that you led the Ardley and Fewcott's residence group against a certain Paul Tucker who'd just taken Silk, opposing large-scale wind farm close to their villages. So tell me your experience on the coal face of planning as literally an activist from the residence side.
So,
how did you find us?
As you've just outlined, Paul, I had a really exciting career in law. I love being part of TESOL, as we then called it, now the Government Legal Department. I did some really exciting cases. I did feel that I was at the cutting edge of public law nearly all the way through my career as human rights developed and judicial review really, really grew in the period from 1995 when I started to 2014 when I left, and indeed, of course, continues to do so. So that was really exciting. On the side, I found myself getting more and more drawn into community activities of various kinds. I was very involved locally in the fight to stop HS2. And we've all seen what's happened there. And I also became very engaged, as you say, in the community activity to try and stop the building of some totally inappropriately sized wind turbines. you can argue with me, Paul, you did at the time, in Ardley. And that was actually my first hands-on, as was probably very obvious, exposure to the planning inspectorate. And I remember spending three happy days in a cricket pavilion in Banbury with you arguing our socks off as to whether or not these things should be built. And of course, I'm very pleased every time I go past Ardley, which is daily, I'm very pleased that they haven't been built. You're probably a bit less so, I should think, Paul.
Well, far from it. I won the inquiry, but the wind turbines weren't built. So essentially, it was a score draw as far as I'm concerned.
As far as I'm concerned, I think some of the conditions we may have put on their building may have had something to do with the fact that they were never What I take, though, genuinely from that experience is obviously I enjoyed meeting you and the other barristers involved. It was good to see a different part of the system operating, and a part of the system that is effectively public law, and definitely had read across from what I was doing in my day job and the bit of law that I love and know about. And it was also good to see that a residents group could genuinely mount a serious challenge and put its points across and explain why the conditions of building were necessary. And that was, in reality, what led to these things not being built. So in a funny sort of way, it showed the system working. And I thought that was quite an interesting lesson to take away. It was also, for me, politically, a very interesting experience, because we were able, in the course of a few months, to corral expertise from probably four or five villages, which was extraordinary. We had a couple of lawyers. One of them became a really very good planning lawyer. Yeah. You may remember Rowena Meagher.
I do, now number five.
I think hadn't even done pupillage and was very new to the system. We found some surveyors, we found some noise experts, we found some engineers, we found a very nice chap who's since become very involved in local politics. All of these people were always my neighbours, but they became my friends during the course of this campaign. My children still remember it. It was a long time ago now, 13 or 14 years ago, but it was all consuming, like all local campaigns are. And I remember fighting the might that was your clients in a way that was possible, but did feel quite difficult at times. And I remember thinking that local politics was worth it. And that was definitely one of the reasons that I then decided to put my name forward to be the MP for Banbury when the vacancy came up.
That really is interesting. And that is I feel slightly vindicated having jokingly put that to you a moment or two ago. Of course, that's not your only brush with the planning system. I think subsequent to that inquiry, there was then an incinerator proposal that was close to villages. So you got involved in terms of that. But from your involvement at the time, what part of the system would you want to change? What did you think, actually, that's not particularly working well from the residents' perspective?
I do think it's really important that the residents' voice is heard, but I think we've found ways of making sure that that happens. So the incinerator was built. I wasn't nearly as involved in that campaign. I'm not saying I would have stopped it had I been. But I think, as ever with planning law, if people can see an end goal that they know is something to do with them, that they need, so we all produce rubbish every day, and the incinerator has made great steps locally to make sure that it's part of the community. It invites in schools and community groups all the time. I've been a really frequent visitor. And I think if people can see why something is needed and they're sure that the right traffic mitigations, for example, are in place, that's always a big issue around us, I think they're prepared to accept it. It's when they can see nothing in it for them and no connection to their lives at all that people find new development really quite difficult to take. But I do think the government is taking steps to make sure that the local voice is heard, and I think that's very important. For us locally, probably about 40% of my postbag is about planning issues. They might not look quite like that. They might look like worries about finding the right medical provision, for example, but a lot of that is rooted in growth. We are a very, very high growth area, and we've changed enormously since I was a little girl in our area. And I think it's important. We're quite proud of that, actually, and we're proud of the growth that's taken place. I built my own house over 20 years ago now, and that's very much part of what we are locally. What we do need to do is own it and make sure it's growth that suits us.
One thing I did learn during the course of that inquiry, my inquiry against you, was never, ever call it Cherwell. Always Charwell.
It varies. But it depends if you're born north of a place called Adderbury or south of a place called Adderbury. And if you're, well, I was born in Banbury, so I was born north, but I was brought up just south in a village called Aino, and we definitely call it Charwell.
Oh, right. Well, I was born well north of Aino. So, yes, I'm right to call it Charwell then. But I've spent the last couple of weeks actually in Charwell in relation to an inquiry there. So I'm wearing constituency MP's hat. So that's a scheme which is essentially a speculative development promoted on the basis that the plan-led system isn't delivering a five-year land supply and that there's a need for additional housing in the short term because the local plan's taking so long to come on. One of the issues that was stark about that inquiry, which is different from a number of other inquiries that I've been involved in, is that was really good-humoured, good-tempered. Everybody was polite to each other. There's so many times we're in the situation when it's almost pantomime villain when you're at inquiry acting for an appellant, and you're almost overly heroic if you're acting for authorities. How do we take the heat out of what really should be an objective decision in the public interest? What do you think we should do to do that?
Well, I do think it's all about people feeling that their views are considered and their voices are heard. And I think that the work that we've done on the local plan and that we're still doing on the current local plan is all part of that. So I know you've been talking about an application to do with Hayford Park, and that is very much part of the local consensus that we've tried to build about growth in our area. So for a long time, the Charwell or Cherwell plan, if you like, has to be to try to donut our two big towns of Banbury and Bicester with development, and also to build on this big brownfield site, used to be a place where Cold War aeroplanes flew from, very near where I live, called Hayford Park. And it is brownfield. There's a very, very, very long airfield there, and there is lots of space for housing, and we've got a lot of planning permissions already in place for housing. And I know that the developer who you were acting for, who is one of our better developers locally, we get no complaints about the quality of their houses, was keen that we continue to build on the brownfield and not the greenfield. Now, that's something as local residents we like and we approve of. We do have a sort of, I mean, it's never been formalized. It's rarely articulated, actually, but we do have a sort of compact with Charwell that they will try to preserve the rural nature of our villages and build in these, the donuts and on Hayford Park brownfield. And that's worked quite well for the last, 20 odd years, really. And that's one of the reasons that we have tolerated a very high level of growth locally, and the fact that some of these developments are really very high quality, Dorchester being a good example of the quality of the build. And the other thing that's gone really well locally is some of the self-built stuff. So Graven Hill, Kevin MacLeod made a telly program about it, and some of the build exclamation mark self-finish housing, which Charwell owns in the towns, that's gone really well too. And I do think if we can bring people along with us, then we will succeed. It's when people feel done too that they can't cope with growth. And I do think that Charwell should be used as a sort of example of good and sustainable growth in the main. And the fact that my constituency is effectively being halved at the next election is testament to just how much growth there's been.
Wow, that really is quite dramatic. Okay, so moving away from constituency work to MP work. So how different is your role as Attorney General compared to your former role in the GLD? I mean, obviously, you've gone from lawyer to politician, lawyer. Back to lawyer. Pretty exciting.
It's really nice. It's like going back to work. It's just the same people there. And of course, my cohort, because I joined in 97, my cohort are now at the top of the GLD. Treasury Solicitor I've known for many years. She used to be my boss. And a lot of my contemporaries are now effectively running the show. So that's been really nice. The work hasn't changed much. There's more of it. But the substantial public law elements are exactly the same. We just have to address the principles to new problems every day. It feels very much like going back to work for me. It's a really happy homecoming. I must say, when I first became an MP, I did miss law to the extent to which I joined the Justice Select Committee and had very, very happy time for 3 or 4 years on that just to keep my hand in. And I then did a couple of other pre-ministerial and ministerial posts, one during Brexit, helping the leader of the House. And that was quite legal, let me tell you. Yes. And then as Ag and Fish Minister during the final TCA agreements, that was quite legal too. And I have felt that being a lawyer in the Houses of Parliament is really useful. I mean, after all, a lot of what we do is making law all day. So that's been good all the way through. But I must say, coming back to my old work as AG is brilliant, and I've loved it.
Fantastic. I'm just going to skip you. A question I was going to ask you, I'm going to come back to. So let me skip to the next one, because I'm very interested in that last observation. Being a lawyer in the House of Commons is really useful. Obviously, the House of Commons, part and parcel of the legislature, therefore legislating to inform what we do on a day-to-day basis. It's always struck me as interesting that a substantial proportion of members of the House, both houses, are former members of the bar, or current members of the bar that aren't practicing. Albeit the House of Commons data apparently shows that the proportion has been in decline over the last decade or so. So
drastically, 13%.
Yeah.
Whereas in the States or in a lot of other legislators around the world, they're more like 30-40%.
You're obviously seeing my question coming.
Oh, sorry.
No. It's perfectly fine. That's the transparency of my cross-examination. So I'm interested in terms of why do you think it is, in terms of lawyers going into whatever legislature, either here or the States? Is there some synergy? Is it the skill set, or is it that we just... what is it you think we bring to the party?
Well, I think lawyers are usually quite interested in justice and fairness, and that's a good thing. And I think, I mean, call me starry-eyed, but I think most politicians go into politics for very good reasons. They genuinely want to represent their communities often, and more as people are very local. So a lot of my new colleagues are very much formed by their area and are there motivated by wanting to do the best for their area, which I think is getting better and is basically a very good thing. I think lawyers like talking in public and they're not scared by that. We're also not scared by legislation and we pick it up and read it and grapple with it in a way that some of my colleagues don't, frankly, and don't know what things mean and need things explained to them, which is fair enough. They're not trained to read this stuff like we are. So I do think there are synergies. I really do. And I do think we bring useful things to the parties. We can usually crystallize an argument. We can usually understand the other side's point of view. I mean, these are all part of our training. Those are definitely useful things in Parliament. Very little change happens unless you build a consensus around it first. And that's all part of what we're used to doing. And certainly in the planning world, you're very much used to doing.
So just going back to the question I was going to ask you, and am I interested in terms of your point about 40% of the postbag tends to be about planning as a constituency MP, whilst you're also sitting in the cabinet, how do you balance? And just to as a heads up, your parliamentary website, which has got all about the strategic rail interchange, really interesting in relation to that, because that was a huge resource when I had to come to look at that quite recently. But how do you balance what you do as a constituency MP in relation to politics with a small p with what you do as a cabinet member? Are there some sensitivities or how do you balance that?
There are, but it's not usually difficult. You're there to represent your constituents. A lot of what you bring to the party as a local, and not just a local MP, but somebody who is really local. I was literally born in Banbury and we farm in the village called Aino. My dad still lives in the house I was brought up in and I live a couple of miles down the road. It's local knowledge. And actually the strategic, the freight interchange, which we hope won't happen, I was able to bring literal local knowledge to the proposed developers, which they didn't have. And I was able to say, have you considered the gauge on the railway? Have you considered the water table? I know as a local farmer how soggy those fields are. I know how small that railway is. I know where the bridges on that railway are. I know how the traffic builds up at certain times of day on that roundabout as you try to get into the M40. So that knowledge is not necessarily as a local MP, but it is very much informed by my position, if you like, as a local, and a local who's always been interested in how communities hang together and what makes them tick. So that I think is useful, and that is quite different from acting as a cabinet minister. I do try not to get involved in planning locally if it's a small issue. It's only these really big existential issues for the local community that I do have a view on. But I must say that it's partly because we are such an enormously high growth area. Planning is a big deal for my constituents, and that's fair enough.
Well, just picking that point up and now wearing your hat as a daughter of a farmer, your constituency, notwithstanding it's a high growth area, has also got a very large rural hinterland. Now, we've got a lot of change in relation to agriculture, both post-Brexit, but also we've got biodiversity net gain. We've got nutrient offsetting. We've got ways in which the farming industry has an opportunity to, if you will, take a commercial advantage from how the planning system operates. So I'm interested in knowing about how you view that sort of change from your perspective as the daughter of a local farmer.
Well, I genuinely think that our post-Brexit farming policy is very exciting and is a way to move our farming industry, of which I'm very proud and very much part of, into a place that is better for the environment in the long term. And I've seen that with the way our new DEFRA incentives are able to make me as a farmer behave differently from the way that we used to behave. One of the things we've learned to do may sound basic, but is genuinely game changing, is plant cover crops over winter. So in our grain producing fields, we now use cover crops. That really, really helps with carbon capture, but it also reduces runoff, which has big implications for planning law. And, you know, if we farmland is 70% of the land in this country, if we can make incremental change, which improves biodiversity and carbon capture, then we are really doing something in the long term for the public good. And I'm very proud of the way that our DEFRA policies are moving us in that direction. And I've seen, as a bog standard farm, if you like, how we are being shifted into ways that my grandfather would have thought were perfectly normal. But the way that my dad farmed in the 80s and 90s was not like that and was not as environmentally friendly. I think the shift from arable only back to mixed farming is one that is interesting. It doesn't mean we all have to own livestock, but we can encourage other people's livestock to graze over the winter. That can help, we hope, for example, with flea beetle on our seed rape. I think of all of these changes, which my grandfather, frankly, would probably have laughed at me and said, yeah, of course we do that, are for the good. And I think this is a really exciting time for British farming. I would say that. I was the agriculture minister for a long time.
Yes, and ag and fish means agriculture and fisheries, as I understand it. Yeah. I had to think about that for a moment. Thank you very much, Victoria. That's all of my questions. Mary, do you have a question for Victoria?
I do. Thank you very much, Paul.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. My question is about training. We know that local councillors receive training on their duties in public life, albeit some of us might think that that should be more extensive and perhaps begin pre-election. But my question is, what, if any, training and support do wannabe MPs receive? And is it adequate? Because I'm keen that we should be encouraging, shouldn't we, high caliber applicants from all backgrounds. And really, I just wonder whether more professional support is required.
So certainly in the Conservative Party, there is quite a good training system that for women called Women to Win, which has been brought up because David Cameron in particular identified that he didn't have enough female candidates, and he actively went out and looked for them and then trained them to succeed in the selection process. And that's led to me having some really fantastic women colleagues who I suspect otherwise would not have been found, Gillian Keegan among them, for example. She said that publicly. So, and the other parties have something quite similar. And I know that the bodies work together to make sure that they're providing the same sort of training. So that gets you as far as selection if you're female. I suspect that there are other bits of diversity and inequality that also get reached by specific training and outreach bodies. And I think that's all to the good. Frankly, the more diverse the intake into parliament, the better, and the more we represent our local communities. In terms of when you arrive in parliament, so I arrived in 2015, and we did have a sort of induction, I suspect 2 or 3 days. I struggle to remember. The whole thing was such a blur. Yeah. And you get given so much tech information, you know, people to help you, no office. I mean, you know, there's an awful lot to take in. I do wonder, and I often think this with staff in the office as well, if it's worth doing induction at the beginning and then revisiting it a few months later when you've worked out the tech, the office, how the pass works and where the toilet is, basically. Because otherwise, it's just too much to take in right at the beginning. So I do think there's an argument from that. I think they have learnt from my induction in 2015 and improved things since then. But you'd have to ask a new MP what happens at the moment. We also, which is really brilliant, have a system of mentors. So each MP gets a sort of buddy, which, I mean, obviously it's only as good as the buddy wants it to be, but that really helps. And I'd like to think as well that MPs continue to, I don't know, nurture and grow each other in the course of their professional development. Certainly, I've got a couple of people I keep my eye on with the new intake. And I suspect that's often the case. I also, with people who aren't MPs yet and may never be, definitely have a series of mentees. And I think this is an idea I got from the bar in particular, who I'm very fond of and keen to develop. I was really lucky at the bar. So I had brilliant pupil masters who I'm still in touch with, Ian Burnett, who was the Lord Chief, and, yes. and Dominic Grieve, who was AG. I still see them both very regularly, and I'm very fond of them. And my mentor, I was also very lucky, was Lord Judge, who's died recently. Mm. And he was brilliant, and certainly as recently as 6 months ago would check in with me and see how I was doing and talk through ethical issues if I wanted to. And I think that sort of lifelong mentoring is something the bar does extraordinarily well, actually.
Indeed, indeed. And I mean, I'm sitting in a law firm, which I started some years ago, and all of the things that you've described are routine good practices here.
Yeah.
I just feel actually that as professional politicians, you ought to have access to a professional secretariat. And that yeah. ought to be a sort of non-political group of professional administrators. That
we are, to a certain extent. We have the House staff who provide an HR function, for example. And I've always found them to be fantastic when I've needed them, whether it's something, you know, an IT issue or a member of staff issue, which is really a complicated HR issue.
Yes.
And they've always been full of advice and help and support. And I think that function has developed over recent years.
Mm. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Mary. Chris, do you have a question for Victoria?
I do, Victoria. Hello.
Hi, Chris.
Hi.
I love the t-shirt and the background. Wow.
Yeah, getting into Christmas. My kids thought this t-shirt would be good for today. The Attorney General, we've got two in my chambers, actually, or two of your recent predecessors, Jeremy Wright, who I think is MP for Kenilworth, and the fabulous Suella Braverman as well was in our chambers. And we almost had some more. We had a Neil Shastri Hurst, who is the...
I saw him at the weekend. He's a resident of Banbury.
Because he was the candidate for Wem, but obviously there was a huge landslide victory for the Liberal Democrats. But
he's one of those interesting people, sorry to interrupt your question, we will get to it in a sec, who's been both a medic and then a lawyer. And I always think they bring something else to the party.
And he's been in the army, so he's a very strong candidate, just probably not in Wem. My question then is, what is the hardest thing about being an MP?
You want so much for your area. And it is your job to do your best for your area and to make their voice heard in Westminster. And you feel that very deeply, I think. And, you know, we're not successful in every funding bid. We want to be, but we're not always. And it is making sure that you are always thinking strategically about what is best for your area and not just what people are shouting loudest about, which... might be animal welfare, might be forestry. It's very odd what people write to you about compared with what the majority of locals really care about. You do feel quite a sense of responsibility being a local MP. For me at the moment, it's simply being able to spend enough time there because, of course, I am the jobbing lawyer for government. I often have to be in Westminster. If the Prime Minister wants legal advice, I have to literally leap on the train and come. And that's the job, and that's fine, but it does mean I'm not at home as much as I used to be.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much indeed, Chris. I'm going to go to Charlie next. Now, Charlie will claim that he's in Dubai. He's not. He's actually on a long weekend in Weston-super-Mare, so don't believe the fact he tries to talk up his life. It's pathetic. Charlie, do you have a question for Victoria?
I do. In fact, I have two, as my case has made me scratch my head. So, Victoria, the first one relates to another aspect of your role, which is as Advocate General for Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Now, a number of our fellow members of the panelling profession, lawyers and consultants, undertake work in Northern Ireland. In fact, Paul and I are both called to the Northern Irish Bar.
So am I.
So are you, indeed.
Yeah.
As I know. I'm keen to know what you've made of your experience of the Northern Irish legal system, and are there any lessons that we can learn from it here in England?
Well, it's lovely in that it's very close. A bit like the Edinburgh system as well, actually, and they operate, instead of out of chambers, out of a library, so everybody sees each other pretty much most days. You really are only as good as your last case because everybody knows everything about what's going on. And all of that is good, but it's also, I suspect, quite, well, you have a reputation to maintain, and I suspect it's quite a strain as well. I also had a really interesting experience recently in that I went to the Irish bar and was wined and dined by them and did various speaker meetings. And that was another important but relatively close legal pool. And I think all of them have, I mean, of course they have strength. They're great citizens. They produce some great lawyers who by heck can talk in court and have very strong reputations. I've really valued my engagement with all of them. And actually in the office, we have the AG for Scotland, who is such an asset. He spent 25 years at the criminal bar in Scotland as a silk there and really brings something to my public law party that I otherwise wouldn't have. He uses a slightly different terminology from time to time, but we tend to understand each other. And one of the great strengths, I think, has been that me and the Solicitor General recently changed, but I'm very pleased with the new one as well as the old one, and the AG for Scotland, is that we tend to produce legal advice together, particularly when it's controversial. And getting three people with quite different legal backgrounds into the same place is quite a useful exercise in itself. And we hang out in Parliament up a legal corridor where all our offices are next to each other, and we tend to keep the doors pretty open. And that is a real strength as well, because challenge and talking to each other, as we all know from chambers or law firms, is very much key to how our profession gets itself into the best legal argument. And I really value having them around.
Your office is literally in the heart of Parliament physically, which I think is rather simple.
It's supposed to be deeply symbolic. So we're not on the ministerial corridor with the other ministers because we're independent and we have to be able to give independent legal advice. And we're also halfway between the Lords and the Commons. So we're supposed to be able to face in both directions. And actually, a lot of what I do is what the whips euphemistically call handling. And I prefer to describe explaining legal advice, I think is how I describe it. But an awful lot of our job, all three law officers, is explaining the legal position, particularly in new legislation, to members of the Lords and the Commons. And of course, in the Lords, we've got some pretty good lawyers. So we engage with them a great deal. And that's something which is a great honour, actually.
Indeed. The second question relates to remote hearings. Planning hearings and inquiries went entirely virtual, like pretty much all other litigation, I think, except serious jury trials. Now we've gone back in our planning world to disputes largely being heard in person, save for things like case management conferences. Let me just know, from your perspective, what do you see the future role of digital technology such as remote hearings in litigation? Is it for the good, for the ill, or somewhere in between?
Well, I've always been quite keen. So even before I left the bar, which was in 2014, we were doing phone hearings. Mm-hmm. And I remember, particularly for interim applications, and I remember thinking at the time, wow, this is the future. This is great. And my job was often to get injunctions at weekends on behalf of the government. And that just revolutionised life when we could do that on the phone. It really did. Having said that, I'm married to a judge, as you know, and he doesn't half like having a witness in front of him, particularly one whose credibility is under review, shall we say. During COVID, he conducted hearings. There was always a great row as to who should take up more of the Wi-Fi at home. We had university exams, A-levels, hearings, and then whatever I was doing in Parliament, all competing for whatever bandwidth was available in Oxfordshire. It was very tricky to know who won sometimes. But he was conducting hearings at home, which was fine. And it was good because it meant that his court doesn't have a backlog, and that definitely needed to happen. And I'm sure we all learned things that we needed to learn. But occasionally, when you do have a witness, particularly a witness whose credibility is under threat, you do need, or it's better if you can eyeball them. Also, I'm very keen that we look at new and creative ways of doing the outside court stuff that happens quite naturally outside court, but of course doesn't when you just log on for the remote. And we need to find a way of baking in settlement opportunities if you're not all meeting each other in person. But I'm a big believer in technology making our lives better. I really am. And as somebody who worked flexibly when I had small children, I was, if you like, an early adopter. While being very untechy, I approve of what tech can do for law. So, I mean, as long as we go forward in a way that is sensible and we keep questioning why, I don't think we should all be going off to court for no reason if we can do something better online. I really don't. I mean, frankly, you could perhaps be dealing with Dubai from Weston-super-Mare. I don't know. But if it was if it was a question of settling it, then maybe they did need you there in person. And that's
It actually is. I can't say too much about it as it's an arbitration, but it's actually a remote hearing, but with various people all over the world. But the three arbitrators felt we ought to be in the same place to confer and so we could ask questions. And
that's maybe got you in a good place. I do think, I mean, travel is still worth it, definitely. Yes. And I, well, the last time I travelled for a case was to The Hague to do the Russia-Ukraine ICJ opening. And that was definitely worth it. It gave me an opportunity to meet the other 31 states who are broadly on Ukraine's side. It gave me an opportunity to see the way the Russians put their case. And, you know, you do pick things up from meeting real people in real life that you don't online. But having said that, there is definitely more we can do remotely. And I hope we will keep, not just because we have to because of the pandemic, but I hope we will keep testing the boundaries of that. I really do.
Thank you.
I did warn you, Victoria, that he'd try and talk up Dubai. In fact, in the backdrop is the opening to the chip shop that Charlie's working at the weekend. thank you, Charlie. Sasha, do you have our final question for Victoria?
I do. Thank you, Paul. Victoria, obviously with your background working in TESOL and since entering Parliament, this isn't a political question in any way, but how have you found members, irrespective of political party, members' approach to the rule of law? How would you characterise how seriously or not members of Parliament understand and accept the rule of law?
I think they do, broadly. I think the type of MP that we've got is changing a bit. And I hinted at that earlier in that we have more local MPs. We perhaps have fewer history and PPE graduates, though we still have a very, very large number. And they, of course, are people who are academically interested in how the Constitution hangs together and the rule of law. But the new type of MP can also bring something to this table, not least because they've often had experience in local government. And oh boy, well, you'll know from the planning system, do you see rule of law issues red in tooth and claw in local government? And I think that can be quite helpful background, actually. So they might not call it the rule of law, but they know that the way that the Constitution hangs together really matters. I think perhaps all MPs feel this, but I think since I've been elected in 2015, we've had an extraordinary amount of constitutional change. And that's brought these issues into the public consciousness in a way that I don't necessarily wish it had all happened, and I certainly don't wish a pandemic had happened. But I think that's quite a good thing for people understanding the importance of the way our constitution works. I thought Miller and the prorogation was the first time that many of us had said those sentences out loud, if you like. We might have thought it academically and even legally, but that didn't mean we'd crystallised what we thought about which bit of the institutions did what. I think actually the death of the late Queen and the coronation of a new king has also helped us to think about that side of our extraordinary constitution. And yeah, it's up there, it's talked about, and that's got to be good, hasn't it? Even if people are continually pushing against it. What I've taken from the tumult, if you like, since 2016 has been that the constitution works.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Paul.
Victoria, thank you so much. We could talk for hours. There's so many different routes that we could go down. We could create an entire podcast series of our own in relation to this, but I appreciate that you are extraordinarily busy. And this has been recorded in the run-up to Christmas, so busy as a constituency MP, as a member of a family, as the Attorney General. So thank you so much for giving us your time. It is massively appreciated. And I look forward to next time I encounter you at somewhere near Ardley and Fewcott.
Oh, thank you, well, Victoria. Let's hope so. But it's lovely to see you all. And please go and run the planning bar. It's missed you for half an hour.
thank you very much, Victoria.
Bye. Thank you.